Supernaturalism. When the narrator of Joseph Conrad's novel Under Western Eyes writes that the belief in a supernatural source of evil is not necessary, men alone are quite capable of every wickedness, he seems to be speaking for the author, who shunned the supernatural in his fiction. Nevertheless, Conrad was a great depictor of what he felt was an ineffable deviltry that nests in the shadows of all that is. And any close reader of Conrad will perceive the impure breath of the supernatural in many of his works. In Heart of Darkness, for example, he pulls at the collar of psychological realism, plying his genius for nuance and stealing up to the very border of supernaturalism. By proceeding thus, Conrad impresses upon his audience the consciousness of a horror that goes beyond the human and takes in all of being. Conrad's odyssey into horror begins when the narrator of Heart of Darkness, Charles Marlowe, acquires a position with a European business concern as the skipper of a steamboat. His first charge is to guide the vessel down a snaking African river to a remote outpost run by one of the company's best men, Mr. Kurtz, a prolific supplier of goods to his employers. At every point, Marlowe feels his journey is taking him farther and farther into an unholy land as he progresses toward his destination. Thus, going up that river was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world, when vegetation rioted on the earth and the big trees were kings, an empty stream, a great silence, an impenetrable forest. The air was warm, thick, heavy, sluggish. There was no joy in the brilliance of sunshine. The long stretches of the waterway ran on, deserted, into the gloom of overshadowed distances. On silvery sandbanks, hippos and alligators sunned themselves side by side. The broadening waters flowed through a mob of wooded islands. You lost your way on that river as you would in a desert, and butted all day long against shoals, trying to find the channel, till you thought yourself bewitched and cut off forever from everything you had known once, somewhere, far away, in another existence, perhaps. There were moments when one's past came back to one, as it will sometimes when you have not a moment to spare to yourself. But it came in the shape of an unrestful and noisy dream, remembered with wonder amongst the overwhelming realities of this strange world of plants and water and silence. And this stillness of life did not in the least resemble a peace. It was the stillness of an implacable force brooding over an inscrutable intention. It looked at you with a vengeful aspect. I got used to it afterwards. I did not see it any more. I had no time. I had to keep guessing at the channel. I had to discern, mostly by inspiration, the signs of hidden banks. I watched for sunken stones. I was learning to clap my teeth smartly before my heart flew out, when I shaved by a fluke some infernal sly old snag that would have ripped the life out of the tin-pot steamboat and drowned all the pilgrims. I had to keep a lookout for the signs of dead wood we would cut up in the night for next day's steaming. When you have to attend to things of that sort, to the mere incidents of the surface, the reality, I tell you, fades. The inner truth is hidden, luckily. But I felt it all the same. I felt often its mysterious stillness watching me. This passage substantiates that you do not need the supernatural to invoke the supernatural. Reality fades more and more as Marlowe approaches Kurtz, who embodies the horrible inner truth of things. On the level of narrative, this inner truth is outwardly made plain by one look at Kurtz's base of operations, where the barbarous means of his successful career are visible everywhere. But Kurtz is not just a bestial headman managing a trading post in Africa. His whole meaning as a character is much more than that. What the brutally atavistic Kurtz signifies to Marlowe surpasses the wickedness of men, and deposits the steamboat captain on the threshold of an occult truth about the underpinnings of the only reality he has ever known, the anchoring fictions of civilization. If Kurtz is simply a man who has realized his potential for wickedness, which by inference is a potential for each of us, then he is merely another candidate for incarceration or the death penalty. But if he is a man who has probed the mysteries of something that is wicked in its essence, then he has crossed the point of no return, and his last words, the horror, have prodigious implications. Not to say that the assorted overtones that literary critics have heard in the story, civilization is only skin deep, European colonialism was a bad business, are not horrors, but they are not the horror that every incident of the narrative prefigures. In Heart of Darkness, Conrad did not cede the horror a local habitation and a name, example, the creature from the Black Lagoon, but artfully suggested a malignity conjoining the latent turpitude of human beings with that active in being itself. As a species, we might have been saved both from our turpitude, latent or not, and from any notion of turpitude active in being itself. The real horror, the real tragedy, is that we were not saved. In an 1898 letter to the Scottish writer R.B. Cunningham Graham, Conrad wrote, "Yes, egoism is good, and altruism is good, and fidelity to nature would be the best of all, if we could only get rid of consciousness. What makes mankind tragic is not that they are the victims of nature, it is that they are conscious of it. To be part of the animal kingdom under the conditions of this earth is very well, but as soon as you know of your slavery, the pain, the anger, the strife, the tragedy begins. We can't return to nature, since we can't change our place in it. Our refuge is in stupidity. There is no morality, no knowledge, and no hope. There is only the consciousness of ourselves, which drives us about a world that is always but a vain and floating appearance." Too conscious that Heart of Darkness was not the place for such discourse, Conrad gave us Marlowe's sensitivity to an implacable force brooding over an inscrutable intention, and Kurtz's resonant last words. If our species was not saved from consciousness, at least the letter was saved, so that we could know what horror was in Conrad's heart. Some horror writers are not the least concerned with the wickedness of men, but exclusively attend to an implacable force brooding over an inscrutable intention, which is to say, something pernicious behind the scenes of life that makes our lives a living nightmare. For Lovecraft, this all-embracing nightmare became the grounding for the supernaturalism of his writings, most famously in his negative mythology of multidimensional horrors, sometimes collectively designated as the Great Old Ones, who came to Earth from other worlds, much like the Body Snatchers and the Thing. Their individual names alone, some of which were referenced earlier in this book, convey their otherworldly demonism. Here are some other names: Dagon, Yog-Sothoth, and Shub-Niggurath, the goat with a thousand young. Lovecraft also wrote of unnamed beings that may be apprehended only by their sensory attributes, as with the eponymous entity in The Color Out of Space, or the unobserved source of the exquisitely low and infinitely distant musical note that sounds in the blackness above the Rue d'Auzay in The Music of Erich Zahn. In composing the latter work, Lovecraft came up with a model supernatural horror tale, one in which a subjective mind and an objective monstrosity shade into each other, the one projecting itself outward, and the other reflecting back, so that together they form the perfect couple, dancing to the uncanny music of being. The mind in the story is that of the nervously afflicted narrator. The monstrosity is the unnamed and unnameable nemesis of the nervously afflicted Zahn. With his viol playing, Zahn battles to keep at bay this thing that would destroy an already tumble-down world as represented by the Rue d'Auzay, the street on which he lives and where he dies. In The Music of Erich Zahn, Lovecraft offers no sanity or system of meaning. What he does offer are Zahn's weird notes, which correspond to powers of disorder that scoff at our fabricated world and show us the horror of our lives. Belief in the supernatural is only superstition. That said, a sense of the supernatural, as Conrad evinced in Heart of Darkness, must be admitted if one's inclination is to go to the limits of horror. It is the sense of what should not be, the sense of being ravaged by the impossible. Phenomenally speaking, the supernatural may be regarded as the metaphysical counterpart of insanity, a transcendental correlative of a mind that has been driven mad. This mind does not keep a chronicle of man's inhumanity to man, but instead tracks a dysphoria symptomatic of our life as transience in a creation that is natural for all else that lives, but for us is anything but. The most uncanny of creaturely traits, the sense of the supernatural, the impression of a fatal estrangement from the visible, is dependent on our consciousness, which merges the outward and the inward into a universal comedy without laughter. We are only chance visitants to this jungle of blind mutations. The natural world existed when we did not, and it will continue to exist long after we are gone. The supernatural crept into life only when the door of consciousness was opened in our heads. The moment we stepped through that door, we walked out on nature. Say what we will about it and deny it till we die, we are blighted by our knowing what is too much to know and too secret to tell one another if we are to stride along our streets, work at our jobs, and sleep in our beds. It is the knowledge of a race of beings that is only passing through this shoddy cosmos. As explained in an earlier section of the present contrivance, literary use of the supernatural may strikingly differ among the works of diverse authors, or even within the output of a single author. A noteworthy example of the latter case displays itself in a comparison of two of Shakespeare's greatest plays, Hamlet and Macbeth. In Hamlet, the supernatural element is extraneous. In Macbeth, it is integral. While both dramas are patterned along the lines of a soap opera, complete with squabbles, schemes, betrayals, and deceptions in a world on the make, Macbeth is played out within a supernatural order that is reinforced throughout the play and gives it a terrible mystery that Hamlet lacks. The latter tragedy does have its ghost, but this apparition serves only as a dramatic device to get the plot moving, which could have been done without an otherworldly intervention that gives away the work's central secret from its commencement, and in no sense tinctures the incidents of the play with a tenebrous and malefic presence, as is the case with Macbeth. Without the three witches, a.k.a. weird sisters, sisters of fate, who officiate as masters of a power that reduces the characters of the story to the status of puppets, Macbeth would not be Macbeth. Without the ghost of Hamlet Sr., Hamlet would still be Hamlet. As we all know, later in the drama, Hamlet the Younger doubts the words of his father's presumptive spirit and double-checks them by having a troupe of actors stage a number called The Murder of Gonzago, so that the indecisive protagonist can see for himself how the new king, his uncle Claudius, responds to the play's reenactment of how he killed his brother. Hamlet needs earthly evidence, not just the words of a revenant, to confirm the crime. The play's the thing, not the ghost. It is just too much that after all the inside information thunderously told by Hamlet the Elder in the first act, Hamlet the Younger would still feel the necessity to engage in his own detective work before making his move. Another setup could have been used to point the finger at Claudius's nefarious deed, a snoop in the shrubbery, perhaps, and the paternal shade could have been edited from the play. Along with this excision, there would be lost a side issue of interest to Shakespeare scholars, to wit the bard's treatment of Catholicism's doctrine of purgatory, but nothing apposite to the story would have gone missing. and the matter of whether or not the ghost is truly that of Hamlet's father or a lying goblin is not kept so much in the reader or playgoer's mind to be a source of great suspense, and would have derailed the course of Hamlet's plot had it turned out to be the latter. All told, Hamlet is not a work that gains anything considerable from a supernatural intrusion. In both Hamlet and Macbeth, the title characters deliver a mass of majestic rhetoric concerning the mysterious matters of human life. However, there is a dimension of the unknowable in Macbeth that situates us in a world of cosmic misrule outside the boundaries of the natural order. Hamlet is a tragedy of human errors, Macbeth an uncanny puppet show. The springboard of the earlier play is, once more, the treacherous murder of Hamlet's father. That of the later piece is a malicious witchery in the world, an unbodied agency that tugs Macbeth through motions that curse him and his wife as much as they do their victims. The play is a ferment of fatality. Every action is choreographed by a supernaturalism that deracinates its main characters from their natural drives to survive and reproduce, and leads Macbeth to the revelation, among others, that life's but a walking shadow, that death is the thing that makes us uncanny things that have nothing to do with the rest of creation. Hamlet has bad dreams, as do we all, but Macbeth cannot dream. As contracted by fate, he has murdered sleep and knows only a waking nightmare. Plot. In his Idea of the Holy, an inquiry into the non-rational factor in the idea of the divine and its relation to the rational, the German theologian Rudolf Otto writes of the numinous, the holy other, that is, God, as a mysterium tremendum et fascinans, a terrifying and fascinating mystery. Confrontations with the numinous are uncommon outside the lives of religious mystics, who may be terrified by their supernatural assignations, but are never undone by them. For these extremist believers, the supernatural is a terror of the divine, not a demonic horror, and it is the absolute reality. After conjuring up the holy other through prayer and meditation, cultists of the sacred feel themselves to be nothing in its presence, only a bit of crud stuck to the shoe of the numinous. Eventually, so says Otto, they make common cause with the numinous and are able to feel good about themselves. On Otto's say-so, these are encounters with the supernatural in its truest and most encompassing sense. Any others, including those evoked by supernatural horror stories, are primitive or perverted. What else could a theologian say? What other kind of supernatural story would he have to tell? While the idea of the holy has some electrifying moments when things are touch and go, the ending is all blessedness and no harm done. But this is not what readers expect when the supernatural is the featured element. They expect death, good or not so good, and will feel swindled if they do not get it. Because death is what really terrifies and fascinates them. In the midst of their lives, they are deep in death, and they know it. They do not know the numinous, which hangs back from life and welcomes very few into its circle. Why things should be this way is the real mystery. The context of Otto's tract is the nature and origins of religion, a respectable fixation for scholars, divines, and anyone else who has a few coins to throw in the pot. But paranormal researchers have written with as much conviction, investigative rigor, and personal experience about their own field of study. They too have tales to tell of the terrifying and fascinating, as if anyone could have a monopoly on these emotions or reserve their copyright for true believers only. The supernatural is in the public domain, and whatever the ontological angle, it is packaged with plots that are missing from the natural world. When we and our prototypes were part of that world, our lives had as little plot to them as the doings of Earth's flora and fauna. Later, As our consciousness began to inflate, we strayed off from the natural. Our bodies stayed behind, but our minds searched for stories with better plots than just survival and reproduction. However, these stories could not be set in the natural world, where there are no stories, where things just happen willy-nilly and events have no meaning outside of material practicality. These stories had to have plots at a distance from biology. Say what we like, we do not believe ourselves to be just organisms. Ask any medical researcher in his home sweet home if he thinks of himself and his wife and kids in the same way he does the animals he left back in the lab. That we are critters is only a scientific technicality. What we see in our mirrors are human beings, and what we need in our diet is the sustenance of stories telling us that we are more than the sum of our creaturely parts. And our supply of this provender comes from only one source, our consciousness, which dramatizes survival as storied conflicts between everyone and his brother, and tricks up procreation as legends of courtly love, bedroom farces, and romantic fictions with or without laughs. But such narratives are not really very far from nature, as we can confirm for ourselves. Those recitals of physical or psychological strife among us, are they really so removed from survival in the natural kingdom? No, they are not. They are still nature, red in tooth and claw. Masked by our consciousness and its illusions to seem uniquely human, our war stories, success stories, and other biodramas are not qualitatively different from their analogues in the wilderness. This goes doubly for romance yarns, those dolled-up variations on mating rituals as seen in nature documentaries. They are not detached from the procreative dog-and-pony show as observed by zoologists and would be dramatically incomplete without a sexual union as their chief motive. Properly considered, they are an ornate pornography, with oft-repeated plots having their climax in a release of tension between two parties and their falling action in what cinematic pornographers term a money shot, which in conventional filmic products is replaced by a kiss or a marriage by way of consummation. As survivors and procreators, we unravel stories that, at their root, are not dissimilar from the habitual behaviors seen in nature. But, as beings who know they will die, we digress into episodes and epics that are altogether dissociated from the natural world. We may isolate this awareness, distract ourselves from it, anchor our minds far from its shores, and sublimate it as a motif in our sagas. Yet, at no time and in no place are we protected from being tapped on the shoulder and reminded, "You're going to die, you know." However much we try to ignore it, our consciousness haunts us with this knowledge. Our heads were baptized in the font of death. They are doused with the horror of moribundity. Death. Do we really believe it is part of the order of our lives? We say that we do. But when it becomes loosened to our imagination, how natural does it feel? W. A. Mozart's attributed last words are apropos here. "The taste of death is on my tongue. I feel something which is not of this world." Death is not like survival and procreation. It is more like a visitation from a foreign and enigmatic sphere, one to which we are connected by our consciousness. No consciousness, no death. No death, no stories with a beginning, middle, and an end. Animal stories of survival and procreation have no comparable structure, because animals have no consciousness of death. Obviously, not all fictional plots end in death, only those which follow a character's life until it can be followed no more. However, in the world of nonfiction, where we are making a go of it on our own, we know how far we will be followed. What we can never know is how and when the following will end. But suppose we did know how and when the ending would take place, what then? How could we go on? Who could live through a story whose ending he or she knew from page one, not in a general sense, but as to the how and when of that ending, which may be a crucifixion and not an easeful cessation? Only because we do not know how or when our life stories will finish can we keep going. We remain in suspense about these details, making it possible for us to follow attentively the twists and turns of our personal plot. And so the story holds our interest for as long as it lasts. Yet everyone knows what is going to happen at the end. We just do not know what it will be like when what is going to happen actually happens. One would think that would be enough to ruin the story, knowing what is going to happen, that no one is going to make it through. Somehow, though, it does not. Our crafty minds have taken care of that. They have thought a thousand different endings, most prominently that of dying in one's sleep, or not thought about the ending at all. But when it comes, it comes. Nothing will turn away that distinguished visitor. After being long refused admittance into our lives, death materializes outside our door and begins pounding to be let in. Now everything quivers with an aura of the uncanny, and nameless shapes begin to form. As the end nears, consciousness surges, and the pieces fall together. Being alive is all right, or so most of us say. But when death walks through the door, nothing is all right. As some believe that life is that which should not be, the bulk of the rest of us believe the same of death. That is its terror and its fascination. Everyone knows that we are all the dead to be. There are gewgaws and knick-knacks that stay in shape far longer than our mortal forms. If we called ourselves dead from the time we are born, we would not be far from the truth. But as long as we can walk or crawl or just lie abed sucking tubes, we can still say that being alive is all right. Without death, meaning without our consciousness of death, no story of supernatural horror would ever have been written, nor would any other artistic representation of human life have been created, for that matter. It is always there, if only between the lines or brushstrokes, or conspicuously by its absence. It is a terrific stimulus to that which is at once one of our greatest weapons and greatest weaknesses, imagination. Our minds are always on the verge of exploding with thoughts and images as we ceaselessly pound the pavement of our world. Both our most exquisite cogitations and our worst cognitive drivel announce our primal torment. We cannot linger in the stillness of nature's vacuity. And so we have imagination to beguile us, a misbegotten hatchling of consciousness, a birth defect of our species. Imagination is often revered as a sign of vigor in our makeup. But it is really just a psychic overcompensation for our impotence as beings. Denied nature's exemption from fictitious designs, we are indentured servants of the imaginary until the hour of our death, when the final harassments of imagination will beset us. Apart from vulgar mortality, supernatural literature also centers on the death of sanity, identity, ideals, abilities, passions, and hand-me-down conceptions about the universe and everything in it. Death is accepted in horror stories because a plot that did not ignite its terrors, in a fictional world, that is, would be a narrative miscarriage. But in real life, few of us hang out in morgues and mausoleum chambers, and even those who do are only perversely inuring themselves to the graphic details of what puts us in these places. Being alive is supposed to be all right, but not when you have no choice but to consider the alternative. An example of how this might happen, one with which most of us are conversant, is the prosaic plot of a vehicular misadventure, a mischance that is ordinarily experienced as a dreamlike ramble with unforeseen stops along the way. Imagine, you may be traveling on a slippery road when, without warning, your vehicle begins sliding across several lanes of oncoming traffic. You know that such things happen. They may even have happened to you on a prior occasion. You know that they happen to other people all the time. Nevertheless, this accident was not in your plans, which is why it is called an accident. In principle, it could be plotted as a cause-and-effect confluence of circumstances, although you would never be able to trace them to their originating source, not even if you went back to the beginning of time. It might occur to you, though, that the responsibility for your accident to come lay with a friend or relative who called and asked you to come over and lend a hand in some fix-it project, because you would not even be out of the house except for that untimely request. Yet you would be just as right to hold other factors responsible. The slippery road on which you were driving, the weather that made the road slippery, all the things that determined the weather, the length of time you spent looking in your clothes closet for the shoes that would be most proper to wear for the fix-it project in question, that interval of perfect extent which made sure you would be just where you needed to be, so that you would not be too early or too late to become involved in a vehicular misadventure. But whatever the proximate or remote causes of your vehicular misadventure might have been, you had an idea of how things were to happen that day, as you do every day, and spinning out of control in your car while other vehicles try to circumvent a collision with you was not on your schedule. 1 second ago you had a firm grip on things, but now you are veering toward who knows where. You are not filled with horror, not yet, as you careen along the pavement that is slick with rain or snow glistening in the moonlight, the wind wailing and shadows scattering. At this point, everything is all strangeness. You have been taken to a different place from where you were just a moment before. Then it begins. This can't be happening, you think, if you can think at all, if you are anything more than a whirlwind of panic. In reality, though, anything can happen now. This is the whispering undercurrent that creeps into your thoughts. Nothing is safe, and nothing is off limits. All of a sudden, something was set in motion that changed everything. Something descended upon you that had been circling above your life from the day you were born. And for the first time, you feel that which you have never felt before, the imminence of your own death. There is no possibility for self-deception now. The paradox that came with consciousness is done with. Only horror is left. This is what is real. This is the only thing that was ever real, however unreal it may have seemed. Of course, bad things happen, as everyone knows. They have always happened and always will happen. They are part of the natural order of things. But this is not how we would have it. This is not how we think things should be for us. This is how we think things should not be. And all supernatural horror, as we remember, derives from what we believe should be and should not be. Yet might we have avoided this horror by warding off our belief in what should be and what should not be, by believing only in what is? No, we could not. We were doomed to hold this belief and to suffer what looms out of it. What doomed us, if one will forgive another imperious repetition of this theme, was consciousness, parent of all horrors, and author of all we believe should be and should not be. While consciousness brought us out of our coma in the natural, we still like to think that, however aloof we are from other living things, we are not in essence wholly alienated from them. We do try to fit in with the rest of creation, living and breathing like any other animal or vegetable. It is no fault of ours that we were made as we were made, experiments in a parallel being. This was not our choice. We did not volunteer to be as we are. We may think that being alive is all right, especially when we consider the alternative, but we think about it as infrequently as possible, for this very thought raises the spirits of the dead and all the other freaks of nature. No other life forms know they are alive, and neither do they know they will die. This is our curse alone. Without this hex upon our heads, we would never have withdrawn as far as we have from the natural, so far and for such a time that it is a relief to say what we have been trying with our all not to say. We have long since fallen from nature's arms. Everywhere around us are natural habitats, but within us is the shiver of startling and dreadful things. Simply put, we are not from here. If we vanished tomorrow, no organism on this planet would miss us. Nothing in nature needs us. We are like Mindlander's suicidal god. Nothing needed him either, and his uselessness was transferred to us after he burst out of existence. We have no business being in this world. We move among living things, all those natural puppets with nothing in their heads. But our heads are in another place, a world apart where all the puppets exist not in the midst of life, but outside it. We are those puppets, those human puppets. We are crazed mimics of the natural prowling about for a peace that will never be ours. And the medium in which we circulate is that of the supernatural, a dusky element of horror that obtains for those who believe in what should be and should not be. This is our secret quarter. This is where we rave with insanity on the level of metaphysics, fracturing reality and breaking the laws of life. Deviations from the natural have whirled around us all our days. We kept them at arm's length, abnormalities we denied were elemental to our being. But absent us, there is nothing of the supernatural in the universe. We are aberrations, beings born undead, neither one thing nor another, or two things at once. Uncanny things that have nothing to do with the rest of creation, horrors that poison the world by sowing our madness everywhere we go, glutting daylight and darkness with incorporeal obscenities. From across an immeasurable divide, we brought the supernatural into all that is manifest. Like a faint haze, it floats around us. We keep company with ghosts. Their graves are marked in our minds, and they will never be disinterred from the cemeteries of our remembrance. Our heartbeats are numbered, our steps counted. Even as we survive and reproduce, we know ourselves to be dying in a dark corner of infinity. Wherever we go, we know not what expects our arrival, but only that it is there. With eyes that see through a translucent veil shimmering before us, we look at life from the other side. There, something escorts us through our days and nights like a second shadow that casts itself into another world and fastens us to it. Leashed to the supernatural, we know its signs and try to tame them by desensitization and lampoonery. We study them as symbols, play games with them. Then an eerily hued light bathes them, and they become real in a peculiar modality. The grinning skull, the curving scythe, the moldy headstone, all the dark creatures of the earth and air, every memento mori we have hidden within us. These skeletons of ours, when will they come out and show themselves? They groan more loudly with each passing year. Time breezes by with chilling haste. Is the child in that old photograph really an erstwhile version of you? Your little hand waving farewell? The face of that child is nothing like the face you have now. That child's face is now melding with the blackness behind you, before you, around you. The child is waving and smiling and fading as your car keeps skidding toward your abruptly curtailed future. Bye-bye. Then another face appears. It has displaced the one you're used to seeing when your rearview mirror goes crooked, as it has now, and confronts you. You cannot look away, because the other face is lit up like a full moon, which both terrifies and fascinates you. And nothing about it looks natural. It seems rigid, the face of something that belongs in a toy chest. The face is smiling, but too much and too long to be real. And its eyes do not blink. The scene shifts moment by moment. People, places, and things appear and disappear. You appeared as others expected, but not as you chose. You will disappear as if you had never been, having taken your turn in this world. You always told yourself that this was the natural way of things, and that you could submit to it because you belonged to nature. Malignantly useless nature, which coughed you up like a little phlegm from its great lungs. Yet the supernatural has cleaved to you from the beginning, working its oddities into your life while you waited for death to begin beating on your door. It has not come to save you, but to bring you into its horror. Perhaps you hoped to make it through this horror that sat like a gargoyle upon your life. Now you find there is no way through. Only seconds are left, each one strangling you a little more tightly. Incantations are spoken all around. They have lost their power. The living and the dead jabber inside you. You cannot understand them. Dreams become more lustrous than memories. Darkness is shoveled over dreams. Those unblinking eyes are still gleaming in the mirror. The eyes of that face smiling too much and too long. And you can feel your own face smiling too, your eyes not blinking. Now that secret you never wanted to know comes into your head, that you were made as you were made and manipulated to behave as you behaved. And as this secret comes into your head, the smile of that face in the mirror pushes up at its edges. So does yours, doing as it is bidden. Both faces at once are smiling the same smile. It widens past all sane proportion. At last, a long-restrained voice cries out, "What is this life?" But only silence answers, and it mocks every mad hope you ever held. No self now, consciously speaking. No feeling your old self or new self. False imaginings, if you think about it. Self-conscious nothings everywhere you look. No one to hear you weep or scream, making a go of it on your own, bye-bye. No arms of nature, abandoned on the doorstep of the supernatural, minds full of flagrantly joyless possibilities, a real blunder that was, the human tragedy. No reality to speak of, nobody here but us puppets, contradictory beings, mutants who embody the contorted logic of a paradox. No immortality, ordinary folk and average mortals coming and going, can't stay long, got an appointment with non-existence, no alternative to consider. Being alive was all right while it lasted, so they say. No life story with a happy ending to tell, only a contrivance of horror, then nothingness, and nothing else. No free will to live, no redemption by a will to die. How depressing. No philosophies to peddle. Pessimism a no-sale. Optimism had to close its doors, too wicked to pass code. No meanings or mind games. Repressional mechanisms broke down. Self-deception shuttered its windows. No awakening from a dream within a dream. Mutation of consciousness. Parent of all horrors. Best not mess with it. Extinction looking better all the time. No more pleasure. What there was of it. A few crumbs left by chaos at feast. Still a good supply of pain, though. No praiseworthy incentives. Just bowel movement pressures. Potato-mashing relativism. No euthanasia. Bad for the business of life. You're on your own there. But watch out for the eternal return. Most horrible idea in the universe. No loving God. Omnipotence off duty, and omniscience on leave. The deity he dead. The horror, the horror. Even the skies of spring and the flowers of summer must ever afterward be poison. Blame it on the piecing together of dissociated knowledge. No compassionate Buddha. Body snatchers got him, heard tell. Or some kind of thing. Maybe next lifetime. No good versus evil formulas around here. Azathoth running the show. Human beings a mistake or a joke. Something pernicious making a nightmare of our world. No being normal and real. The uncanny coming at you full speed, startling and dreadful. No ego death. Enlightenment by accident. no way out of harm's way, better never to have been, worst saved for last. No last messiah, buried in the fingernails of midwives and pacifier-makers, gone the way of messiahs past. No bleakness, either. A failure indeed. No terror management by isolation, anchoring, distraction, sublimation. No tragedies to read or to write. Death kept at a safe distance past the vanishing point down the road. No escape routes into a useless bliss, useless existence, malignantly so. What now? Now there is only that unnaturally spreading smile, a great gaping abyss where blackness reaches out to blackness, nothing. Then the sense of being swallowed. The story is done, the plot complete. Endgame. To contest Zapfe's philosophy, or any philosophy like it, would be as facile as to contest that of any other philosopher whose reasoning does not suit your predilections. If his analysis of human existence appears secure in a certain light, it may be flouted with little exertion by anyone thus motivated. Zapfe did not discover the New World, with a handful of dirt to prove it. He was someone who thought he had worked out why humankind should go extinct, knowing that we would never make that choice, whatever he and his last messiah had to say. Whether we are sovereign or enslaved in our being, what of it? Our species will still look to the future and see no need to abdicate its puppet dance of replication in a puppet universe where the strings pull themselves. What a laugh that we would do anything else, or could do anything else. That our lives might be a paradox and a horror would not really be a secret too terrible to know for minds that know only what they want to know. The hell of human consciousness is only a philosopher's bedtime story we can hear each night and forget each morning when we awake to go to school or to work or wherever we may go day after day after day. What do we care about the horror of being insufferably aware we are alive and will die, the horror of shadows without selves enshrouding the earth, or the horror of puppet heads bobbing in the wind and disappearing into a dark sky like lost balloons? If that is the way you think things are, go shout it from the rooftops and see where it gets you. We are staying put, but you can go extinct if you like. We can make more little puppets like you, but we do not call them that. We call them people who have indivisible selves and stories that are nothing like yours. Being somebody is rough, but being nobody is out of the question. We must be happy. We must imagine Sisyphus to be happy. We must believe because it is absurd to believe. Day by day, in every way, we are getting better and better. Positive illusions for positive persons. They shoot horses, don't they? But as for shooting ourselves, ask Gloria Beatty, ask Michelstetter, ask Weininger, ask Hemingway. But do not ask Mainländer or Björnbu, who hanged themselves, and do not ask Jean Amery, author of Suicide, a Discourse on Voluntary Death, who made his exit with a drug overdose. Amery survived Auschwitz, but he did not survive his survival. No one does. With our progenitors and the world behind us, we will never hold this life to be malignantly useless. Almost nobody declares that an ancestral curse contaminates us in utero and pollutes our existence. Doctors do not weep in the delivery room, or not often. They do not lower their heads and say, "The stopwatch has started." The infant may cry if things went right, but time will dry its eyes. Time will take care of it. Time will take care of everyone until there are none of us to take care of. Then all will be as it was before we put down roots where we do not belong. There will come a day for each of us, and then for all of us, when the future will be done with. Until then, humanity will acclimate itself to every new horror that comes knocking, as it has done from the very beginning. It will go on and on until it stops. And the horror will go on, with generations falling into the future like so many bodies into open graves. The horror handed down to us will be handed down to others like a scandalous heirloom. Being alive, decades of waking up on time, then trudging through another round of moods, sensations, thoughts, cravings, the complete gamut of agitations, and finally flopping into bed to sweat in the pitch of dead sleep or simmer in the phantasmagorias that molest our dreaming minds. Why do so many of us bargain for a life sentence over the end of a rope or the muzzle of a gun? Do we not deserve to die? But we are not obsessed by such questions. To ask them is not in our interest, nor to answer them with hand on heart. In such spirit, might we not bring to an end the conspiracy against the human race? This would seem to be the right course, the death of tragedy in the embrace of non-existence. Overpopulated worlds of the unborn would not have to suffer for our undoing what we have done, just so that we might go on as we have all these years. That said, nothing we know would have us take that step. What could be more unthinkable? We are only human beings. Ask anybody. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Eric Martin. Copyright 2018 by Thomas Ligotti. Recorded by arrangement with the Berkeley Publishing Group, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.